KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
How we would be going 30 or 40 kilometers to take food parcels.
Israel has a new plan to deliver food aid in Gaza. The UN calls it inhumane.
Today is Monday, May 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, Israel's latest ultimatum to Hamas, plus these stories.
Cuts to the World Food Program.
The conclave at the Vatican.
And deportations from the U.S. to Panama.
It was like a prison. No privacy, no good food, no good water.
Later, we say goodbye to Skype.
And the nation's most diverse collection of wildflowers is now in bloom in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee.
We have, you know, plants here in the park that don't grow anywhere else in the world.
Plus, Pulitzer Prizes were announced today.
We'll tell you who the big winners were after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump has signed an executive order restricting federal funding of research, which he calls dangerous. More from NPR's Rob Stein.
The so-called gain-of-function research involves studying how viruses and other pathogens could cause a pandemic by spreading more easily or causing more serious illness. This research has long been controversial, but the controversy intensified because of accusations that the COVID-19 pandemic was caused by a virus that was created during gain-of-function research in China. Many other scientists dispute that and fear a moratorium on funding will block research that could help prevent or respond to the next pandemic. Rob Stein, NPR News.
More than a dozen former employees of the tech firm Palantir are speaking out against the company's work with the Trump administration. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, Palantir technology is being used to identify real-time movements of migrants in the U.S. illegally.
13 ex-Palantir workers say the Trump administration is abusing the data mining tools they helped build. The former employees note that Palantir's advanced surveillance software is helping Immigration and Customs Enforcement track migrants in real time. The letter, shared exclusively with NPR, says Palantir's own code of conduct says its software should not be used to violate people's rights. The letter says, quote, early Palantirians understood the ethical weight of building these technologies. These principles have now been violated and are rapidly being dismantled at Palantir Technologies and across Silicon Valley. Palantir and the White House did not return requests for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
In one of the last wishes he made, Pope Francis requested one of his Pope Mobiles be turned into a mobile health clinic for children in the Gaza Strip. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has this update.
The Vatican's official media says the Pope Mobile that Pope Francis used during his 2014 visit to the Holy Land is being outfitted with diagnostic and emergency medical equipment to help young patients in Gaza. Health services have been decimated during Israel's war against Hamas in the Palestinian enclave. The Pope Mobile will carry things like suture kits and vaccines and be run by medical staff. The Catholic aid organization Caritas Jerusalem, which leads the initiative, has to navigate restrictions on access to Gaza, but ultimately plans to deploy the clinic to communities that now survive without health facilities. Pope Francis called the Holy Family Church in Gaza almost every day throughout the war, including from his hospital bed, as he was critically ill with double pneumonia. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
It's the first Monday in May, which means it's time for the annual Met Gala. This year's theme focuses on Black designers, with about 450 high-profile people from tech, sports, art, entertainment, and more expected at the annual event. It's the first Met Gala in more than 20 years to have a menswear theme. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow up 98 points, or down 98 points. Across the U.S., the pre-dawn sky will be lit up with an annual meteor shower called the Eta Aquarid early this morning. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more on when and how to spot the meteor showers.
It's time to roll out your picnic blanket and unfold those lawn chairs. Prepare for an early morning show. The Eta Aquarid's meteor shower will streak across the pre-dawn sky of May 6th. And according to the U.S. Space Agency, NASA, there will be a lot of opportunities to spot the meteors, as around 50 meteors per hour are expected at the peak of this shower. The best time to see everything is around 3 a.m. That's when the moon will set and the sky will be at its darkest. And the Eta Aquarid's meteor shower will be easiest to spot, as long as you are a good distance away from city and street lights. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Shoe company Skechers, which is famous for its ads touting celebrities stepping into its no-ties shoes, is agreed to be acquired for $9 billion. The company will be taken private by the investment group 3G Capital. The move to privatize the company comes amid mounting concerns over how the Trump administration's tariffs on foreign goods will affect companies that produce much of their products overseas. $63 per share offer for Skechers represents a 30% premium to the company's 15-day volume-weighted stock price. Crude oil futures prices moved lower today, falling by more than a dollar a barrel. That was on continued worries about anticipated output hikes by OPEC and other producers. Oil dropped $1.16 a barrel to settle at $57.13 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Israel has a new ultimatum for Hamas. Release the hostages held in Gaza or else Israel will expand the war. Israel also plans a major shift in how food and supplies are handed out. The United Nations calls that proposal inhumane. NPR's Daniel Estrin is here to make sense of this. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Ari.
What exactly is Israel threatening to do in Gaza?
The Israeli cabinet approved new plans last night. The plans are to intensify the war in Gaza, and Israeli officials have offered some basic details. They plan to seize more land in Gaza and to have soldiers stay there indefinitely, and also to push the population of Gaza into the southernmost area of Gaza along the Egypt border, where they would get their food and basic supplies.
I called this an ultimatum, so how likely is it to actually happen?
That's really unclear. I mean, reservist soldiers are already being called up to report for duty, tens of thousands of them, to help support this expanded offensive. But an Israeli official, speaking on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to speak publicly, has told reporters that they're actually going to give Hamas another week to agree to release Israeli hostages on Israel's favored terms. And they want to wait for President Trump to finish his tour of the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates. He'll finish that up next week and then see whether Hamas agrees. If they don't, then they will continue with this offensive. But one major issue that's already setting up a standoff with the United Nations is Israel's plan for changing the way that they deliver food in Gaza.
I want to ask you about those changes because Israel has already blocked all food and supplies into Gaza for a couple months. You've reported on widespread hunger and malnutrition there. So what is the UN's objection to Israel's new plan for bringing in food?
A lot of objections, and I've spoken to several officials and people briefed on Israel's plans. The plans are to shutter hundreds of soup kitchens and aid centers across Gaza and restrict food to only be delivered in an Israeli military guarded area in southern Gaza, and that U.S. security contractors would be in charge of handing out food and basic household supplies, and that they would use facial recognition screening to vet people coming to get the aid. Now, Israel says that this system will isolate Hamas. Israel accuses Hamas of stealing aid for its own fighters. And Israel has asked the United Nations and other aid groups to take part in this new system, but they say they won't cooperate. They're saying in a statement that this would be using aid as a weapon of war to try to achieve military objectives. Now, our colleague in Gaza, NPR's Anas Baba, asked a resident of northern Gaza, Bassem Shenera, what he thinks. This is a man who is far away from where the food would be distributed.
An absolute crazy. How we would be going 30 or 40 kilometers to take food parcels. And they told us it's like dry food, and not a fresh food, which made us feel like animals, actually.
feel like animals, he says. And it's not just people in Gaza worried about these new Israeli plans for the war. Many soldiers in Israel, reservists, are weary after many rounds of service in Gaza. Even the leader of Israel's opposition has questioned the wisdom of expanding the offensive there.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting from Tel Aviv. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The number of people in the world facing hunger has stayed stubbornly high since the pandemic. At the same time, international support for food aid has been dropping. And then came the Trump administration's dramatic cuts to humanitarian assistance. Now, one of the world's largest humanitarian aid groups is planning to radically downsize. Reporter Gabriel Spitzer has the story.
An email went out recently to employees at the United Nations World Food Program. The subject line said, "Workforce Update." The memo said job cuts are coming. The World Food Program is the major international effort to fight hunger. Last year, the organization reports it served more than 100 million people. 5 years ago, it won the Nobel Peace Prize. In the email obtained by NPR, WFP leadership said to expect staff cuts of 25% to 30%, about 6,000 jobs. They said the cuts will affect every level of the organization in every place they operate. Paul Spiegel directs the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins University.
You know, I've been working in the humanitarian field for nearly 30 years now, and I've never seen such a situation before in these 30 years.
Donor countries in Europe had already been scaling back their contributions. The latest and most abrupt blow came this year when the U.S., the largest funder of the World Food Program, canceled several hundred million in grants. Last year, the U.S. had contributed $4.5 billion to the WFP.
I understand the donor fatigue because there seem to be so many emergencies, but this is different, I think, and we're going to see enormous amounts of, sadly, increased numbers of deaths in these humanitarian settings.
The World Food Program projects that next year the organization will get less than half of what it needs.
In the past, there have been crises where funding has dried up for various reasons, but not on the sort of global scale that we're seeing now.
Harold Manhart is the World Food Program's deputy country director in Afghanistan, where he says the funding cuts have been especially painful. In that country, the U.S. contributed $280 million through USAID last year. This year, the Trump administration canceled those contracts. According to the UN, about half the Afghan population depends on aid for survival, and more than 3 million are on the brink of starvation. And yet, Manhart says the WFP could not afford to keep up with the needs even before the latest U.S. cuts.
Whenever I've been visiting over the last 6 months or so distribution sites, there's a lot of people outside there asking why they can't be included in the programs. We're already only feeding half or less than half of who we should be assisting.
Policy experts say it's not just emergency assistance that will be affected, but also projects meant to make countries self-sufficient. Caitlin Welsh is director of food and water security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It's a bipartisan policy think tank. She says cuts planned at the WFP will also hurt countries over the long term, and a drop in support from the U.S. will only make things worse.
So it's both types of assistance that the U.S. government is cutting, the emergency assistance for those in most need and the other types of assistance that's intended to make sure that people wouldn't need that assistance in the first place.
In a statement to NPR, a State Department spokesperson said that USAID has canceled only a small number of World Food Program contracts, and that those were due to, quote, concerns about funds benefiting terrorist groups like the Houthis and Taliban. The World Food Program would not comment on its planned staffing cuts, but said in a statement it will prioritize its limited resources toward the 343 million people struggling with hunger and increasingly starvation. For NPR News, I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
The most diverse collection of wildflowers at any national park is now in bloom in the Great Smoky Mountains. Jackie Sieber with WUOT in Knoxville, Tennessee, stopped to smell those flowers.
Smell that right there. Just give it a little whiff.
Oh.
A little smell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of got a...
Whoa. On a cool, drizzly morning in a wooded area just outside Gatlinburg, park botanist Ian Sabo is on a hill festooned with colorful wildflowers and blooming shrubs. He bends down to examine a three-petaled white flower with a berry pink center. It's about a foot off the ground. By its smell, he identifies it as a sweet white trillium.
It's got just these really wide, broad, overlapping petals. I think that really kind of gives that one away.
This little trillium is one of over 1,500 types of flowering plants that are found in Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
We have, you know, plants here in the park that don't grow anywhere else in the world. So it's pretty neat, you know.
Like the rhododendron smokianum. The park's spring wildflowers are at their peak right now. Sapo says they attract certain pollinators with their smell, like the red trillium, better known as Stinkin' Willie.
Some folks say it's kind of reminiscent of wet dog, but it's not a very appealing smell. And so that trillium's actually more pollinated by, like, carrion flies.
Sapo spots a yellow trillium near a creek. He pulls out his phone, takes a picture, and enters it into the iNaturalist app. It's used by millions of people around the world. With one picture, the app pulls up suggestions of what it might be.
And it's like, hey, it's a trillium. It's Trillium luteum. It's visually similar, expected nearby.
This app helps the park keep track of its flowers. Todd Witcher is with a local nonprofit that helps catalog the park's wildlife.
We try to encourage people to look for some very specific things we're wanting to know more about. We basically mine the data from iNaturalist to add to our inventory.
He says over the past 3 years, they've added 200 new wildlife discoveries using the app. Sapo says he welcomes people's input. Just be sure you take time to smell the flowers, like the lemony scent of this yellow trillium that's similar to pledge furniture polish.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just don't want anyone picking the flowers, right? But yeah. Smelling the flowers is fine.
For NPR News, I'm Jackie Sieber in Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Today, we are saying goodbye to a technology that produced one of the 2000s most memorable ringtones. Skype. It shut down today.
It used to be super popular. In 2009, the app had more than 400 million users and made up 8% of the world's international calling minutes.
Skype allowed you to call others over the internet, but also to call anyone with a phone number. That was revolutionary back in the mid-2000s. But don't just take my word for it. Here's former All Things Considered host Robert Siegel in August 2005.
There's a delightful experience to making a call on Skype wearing headphones, at least to the ears of a radio person. The line is very high quality. It's much better fidelity than an ordinary phone call.
Microsoft bought Skype in 2011 for $8.5 billion. Over time, Skype became less popular as other platforms like Zoom caught on. And now, Microsoft says it has shifted focus to its Teams app.
I guess you could say connection lost, but this time permanently.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Vatican City, standing on the steps in front of St. Peter's Basilica, looking up at the chimney that was just placed on top of the Sistine Chapel. Beginning Wednesday, the conclave to elect the next pope takes place in the Sistine Chapel. Everybody outside will only know what's going on by looking at this chimney and looking to see if it's black smoke, which means no pope has been elected, or white smoke, which means the pope has been elected. This is a secretive process. But in the past few years, millions of people got a sense of it through the movie Conclave and the best-selling book by the same name. Before we headed to Rome, we talked to Robert Harris, the author of Conclave, to talk about what he's thinking about ahead of this real-life one. Is it true that the election of Pope Francis was what initially inspired you to write this book?
Yes, I saw when he appeared on the balcony. I saw the just before he appeared, the windows on either side filling up with the faces of the cardinals who just elected him. And I thought, this is interesting. I wonder what had happened immediately before in the voting. And I was a political journalist, and I'm a political novelist, really. So I looked it up and started some research and immediately found it was a great story.
That gets to one of the interesting aspects of this. It's in the Sistine Chapel. The stakes are high, being in charge of the Catholic Church. But in the end, is this kind of, do you think about this as just a political convention, really?
Well, it's obviously much more than that, and it has very, very strange and arcane rules. As you say, only 130 or so electors, all of them cut off from the outside world, their phones taken off them, there are no laptops, the windows in their hostel are all sealed, they can't talk to anyone. They're not allowed to take reading material into the Sistine Chapel or bring it out. They're forced to absolutely concentrate. There's a complete vow of secrecy. There's not supposed to be any canvassing. So it's really not like a conventional election. But at the same time, it is political. I mean, someone does emerge from these exhaustive ballots with a two-thirds majority and becomes the leader of 1.4 billion Catholics. So, you know, it's both sacred and profane.
This is a tricky thing to report on and research because the people directly involved in the process are threatened with excommunication if they talk about the details. How did you approach your research?
Well, in two ways, really. I asked the Vatican, I told the Vatican I wanted to write a novel about a conclave, but I didn't ask for any, you know, inside briefing. I just simply asked to see the locations. And they let me see all the locations I wanted. And then I simply researched as much as I could. Although it's supposed to be highly secret, things leak out. It's quite gossipy in Rome and the Vatican. There are a lot of journalists assigned to the Vatican beat. They pick up stories. There was a diary purportedly kept by a Latin American cardinal a few years ago about the election of Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict. That was very useful. And I did actually talk to a cardinal, really just to sort of confirm what I already knew. He didn't spill any secrets, but it gave me confidence to talk to someone who'd actually participated.
When you were researching writing the book, what was the most surprising thing you learned about the conclave process?
I think probably that it was political. I mean, you know, there's a great deal of talk about how it's very sacred and there's no, which it is, and there's no canvassing and so on. But, you know, the truth is that the, for instance, the election of Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger did well on the first ballot. His leading liberal opponent did less well, the Archbishop of Milan. His supporters realized he was going to not make it and so switched their support behind the then unknown cardinal from Argentina, Bergoglio, And the whole conclave very nearly deadlocked. I mean, that was revelatory to me and gave me really three of the characters for the novel, the conservative, the liberal, and the outsider. There was, you know, a drama immediately just there.
On that note, if you had that author's perspective in real life right now, if you could be in somebody's head in this coming conclave, who would you choose? What would you want to know the most about what's going to be going through people's minds over the next week or so?
Well, the vantage point I chose for the novel was the Dean of the College of Cardinals, who was then brilliantly portrayed in the film by Ralph Fiennes. I think that that's a very good perspective. The Dean of the College organizes the election. He preaches to a great mass immediately before the conclave begins, and he effectively runs the whole proceedings. He knows everything. If there are bodies buried anywhere, he knows where they are. So I think that he provides the best vantage point.
That is author Robert Harris, who wrote Conclave, as well as many other bestsellers. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
The Pulitzer Prizes were announced today, recognizing excellence in fiction, drama, and journalism. NPR's Andrew Limbong has more on the winners.
Before presenting the awards, Marjorie Miller, vice president at the Associated Press and the administrator of the Pulitzer Prizes, didn't sugarcoat the tough spot the journalism industry is in these days.
Atop years of severe financial pressures and layoffs, amid the dangers of covering wars and natural disasters, journalists and writers now face additional threats in the form of legal harassment, the banning of books, and attacks on their work and legitimacy.
And yet, award-winning work still gets published. Reuters won the Investigative Reporting Award for its series on how cheap and easy it is to acquire opioids. Journalists at the Baltimore Banner were given the award for local reporting on how hard the opioid crisis is hitting older Black men. The New York Times' Doug Mills won the award for breaking news photography for his coverage of the assassination attempt on President Trump in July. He spoke to NPR the day after it happened.
So I really did not know that it was shots being fired. And I kept taking pictures, and then I realized that he had grimaced, and then he grabbed his ear, and then he took his hand off his ear, and, you know, there was blood on his ear, and then he went down. And I was like, oh my God, he's been shot.
Ann Telnis, formerly of The Washington Post, won the award for illustrated reporting and commentary for reporting on powerful people with, quote, deftness, creativity,
and a fearlessness that led to her departure from the news organization after 17 years.
Telnis left the paper earlier this year after an editor spiked her cartoon featuring tech and media figures bowing at the feet of President Trump. One of those figures was Jeff Bezos, owner of the Post. Over on the art side of things, author Percival Everett won the Fiction Award for his book James, a retelling of Mark Twain's Huck Finn story. And playwright Brandon Jacobs Jenkins won the Drama Award for Purpose, about a politically powerful Black family. In an interview with NPR, he talked about finding his own purpose.
What it is to take it upon yourself to live one's life with a certain sense of conviction and direction, and assume that the generation after you is going to give a crap.
Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Pope Francis appointed most of the cardinals who now elect his successor. Many, like Francis himself, came from outside Europe. So how might they vote? And what does it mean for the Catholic Church? The cardinals in the conclave tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, President Trump says it's a national security threat for movie studios to produce films outside of the U.S.
If they're not willing to make a movie inside the United States, then we should have a tariff on movies that come in.
What that could mean for Hollywood after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Homeland Security Department announced it will be giving a $1,000 stipend to people who, quote, self-deport. As NPR's Jimena Bastille tells us, the Trump administration has invested millions into encouraging people without legal status to leave.
DHS said it will give $1,000 to people who use the CBP Home app to return to their home countries. The money will allegedly be paid after they confirm their arrival through the app. They say this is a way to make it cheaper to remove people from the U.S. According to DHS, it costs $17,000 to arrest, detain, and remove one person. But questions remain on the effectiveness of the program. Immigrant rights advocates say there isn't incentive for immigrants to trust the administration will follow through on payments or the promise that they can return. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
A senior official with the Department of Education announced the agency will be making more funding cuts to Harvard University. As NPR's Jonaki Mehta tells us, the cuts are to future research grants.
The Education Department has already frozen $2.2 billion in federal funding for Harvard in an ongoing battle between the administration and the world's wealthiest university. Now it has announced that Harvard will no longer be eligible for future research grants from the federal government until it can, quote, demonstrate responsible management of federal dollars. The Trump administration has repeatedly alleged that Harvard promotes anti-Semitism, and in a call with reporters, a department spokesperson said Harvard has, quote, spent years ignoring completely a total coordinated effort to drive Jewish life underground. Jonaki Mehta, NPR News.
Meanwhile, a Harvard spokesperson says the letter makes new threats to, quote, illegally withholding funding for life-saving research, adding Harvard will continue to defend itself against government overreach. Stocks finished lower to start the week on Wall Street. This is NPR. It's been 80 years since the end of World War II, and several countries in Europe are holding commemorations this week. Britain kicked off 4 days of parades and memorials for what it calls Victory in Europe Day. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Big Ben's bells signaled the start of a military parade toward Buckingham Palace and an actor's recitation of then Prime Minister Winston Churchill's famous speech 80 years ago this week.
My dear friends, this is your hour.
Announcing that Britain and its allies had accepted Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender. King Charles stood at attention saluting troops, including Ukrainian soldiers taking part this year. The royals and current Prime Minister Keir Starmer were mixed in on a parade stand with World War II veterans, some with walking sticks and wheelchairs. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
The Vatican says the Pope Mobile that Pope Francis used during his 2014 visit to the Holy Land is being retrofitted and transformed into a mobile health clinic for children in the Gaza Strip. Health services in that region have been decimated during Israel's war against Hamas. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 98 points, down about 0.2%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro. Since January, the Trump administration has been trying to get federal workers to quit. They've offered incentives like providing pay and benefits through September. But now people are leaving in droves, by the tens of thousands, in fact, and at least one agency is scrambling to fill key positions. NPR's Andrea Hsu is covering this. Hey, Andrea.
Hey, Ari.
Where in the federal government is this happening?
Well, where I've heard about it is at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and specifically the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS. Ari, this is the agency in charge of making sure that goods coming into the country don't pose a risk to American agriculture. Their employees include people who can identify pests found on imported flowers or wood, for example, and they also train dogs to inspect cargo and luggage. And the idea is you don't want to let something into the country that's going to destroy America's farms or forests.
Why would the Trump administration want to shrink that program?
Well, you know, President Trump has said repeatedly that he has a mandate from the American people to make government more efficient, less wasteful. And as part of that, he's ordered federal agencies to reduce their headcount. Now, agencies, including USDA, have been trying to get people to leave voluntarily, you know, as you said, offering people pay and benefits through September in exchange for resigning now. And the USDA says more than 15,000 employees at USDA accepted the deal since it was first offered. And we're hearing more than 1,000 at the agency we've been talking about, APHIS. And for some, their last day was last Wednesday.
And so what's happening now? The agency is looking to fill some of those jobs of people who left?
Yeah, well, in fact, last Thursday, which was just a day after, you know, some of these people left, Human Resources sent an email to the remaining APHIS employees. That email was shared with NPR. And it said, you know, given the impact of recent and upcoming staff departures, they've been approved to fill 73 positions, and they invited people to apply for lateral transfers. Ari, they're looking for technicians, inspectors, a veterinarian, and others, and they're trying to transfer people into these positions really fast. Applications are due tomorrow, and those chosen will start their new jobs in less than 2 weeks.
It's not unheard of for an employer to go through layoffs and then want to hire people back. Why would this be a big deal?
Well, federal workers I've been hearing from are really angry. And let me tell you about one APHIS employee I spoke with. NPR agreed not to use this person's name because they fear retaliation for speaking out to the media about this. But this employee took the deferred resignation offer, even though they didn't want to leave their job. You know, they took a lot of pride in their work. But there's been so much talk about mass layoffs ahead, including at USDA. This employee tried and couldn't get a straight answer about whether their job would be safe. Meanwhile, federal workers have been told, you know, this deferred resignation offer is a good deal, and if you don't take it, you could end up fired. So this employee quit. And then the very next day, they started hearing from colleagues, you know, who were still at APHIS, who said, hey, your job was just posted. So now this person is furious. They can't believe the government would do this. They feel like none of this has been thought out.
What has USDA said about this?
Well, the press office did not answer our questions about why they let people in mission-critical jobs go. Instead, they sent a statement saying that while Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins is pursuing plans to reduce USDA's workforce, she will not compromise the critical work of the department. And Ari, she'll be on Capitol Hill this week, so we'll see if she takes any questions about this.
And is this happening in other parts of the government, too?
Yeah, in fact, I've heard that the U.S. Forest Service is urgently looking to fill about 900 jobs. Now, we don't know whether all of these openings are due to recent departures, but again, there are lots of questions about what the master plan is here, whether, in fact, there is one.
That's NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Ari.
Across the country, hundreds, if not thousands, of college athletes are in limbo. For months, coaches have been telling players that they'll no longer have a spot on their teams because a major legal settlement involving the NCAA would place new limits on the size of college sports teams. That settlement is in jeopardy after a federal judge pressed pause over the issue, and now these athletes are hoping to get their spots back before it's too late. NPR's Becky Sullivan has their story.
Last fall, the Liberty University women's cross-country team met at a coach's house for a bonfire night. It should have been a celebration of a great season. Instead, the coaches had bad news to share. About half the runners on the team were going to lose their roster spots.
It was just like very much an emotional night, and like I was crying. A lot of people were crying.
Sophia Park is a sophomore at Liberty and one of more than 30 runners on the cross-country team. This proposed legal settlement would limit the size of teams in every sport, her coach explained. For cross-country, the limit would be just 17 runners.
And I was like doing the math in my head, and I just like, my heart dropped, and I was just like, oh, like, this is me too. And like, this could be the end of my time on the team too.
Traditionally, the NCAA never limited how big teams could be. Instead, the only limit was on how many athletic scholarships a school could allot to each squad. But the goal of this huge class action settlement is to remove traditional limits on how schools can compensate athletes. If it's approved by a federal judge, then schools would be allowed to give out as many scholarships as they want. But lawyers negotiating the settlement have argued that to maintain competitive balance, roster limits are needed instead. If they go into effect, thousands of current athletes would have to be cut.
The lawyers are making the case of we are representing the NCAA athletes. And the fact that I'm represented in this case, I'm a plaintiff in this case, and I'm getting cut, like, how is that benefiting me?
This is Tate Cutler. He's a swimmer at Auburn. No sport is immune from the roster limit issue, but men's swimming and diving is one of the big ones. There were reports that the Southeastern Conference, which includes Auburn, was considering a roster limit of just 22. In March, his coaches called Cutler and all his teammates in for meetings one by one. Around 20 swimmers and divers were kicked off the team, including him.
It was heartbreaking. I had given my heart and soul to this program, and I love it so much here. And it's just to have like your dream crushed, like, it's brutal.
All of these cuts were premature, federal judge Claudia Wilkin has said, because the settlement hadn't been approved and the judge has taken issue with the roster limits. She says they would harm some college athletes when the settlement is supposed to help them. So last month, Wilkin sent the lawyers back to the negotiating table. But for some athletes, it's too late. They already transferred to new schools or stopped training altogether. Cutler, who's a junior, is stuck at Auburn if he wants to graduate on time, he told me, and he couldn't bring himself to jump back into the pool for weeks.
It made me like hate the sport that I loved. Swimming's been something I've done since I was 5 years old, and it's really weird not doing it.
The NCAA says schools can't revoke the athletic scholarships of players who are cut as a result of the settlement. But that's not the only way athletes get help paying for college, said Alec Miller, a sophomore track athlete at the University of Florida.
Things like our dining hall, which technically isn't scholarship, so they don't have to provide that to us anymore. But that would also be like thousands of dollars a year extra that I would now be having to spend.
Miller was dropped from the team in March. He could lose his access to physical trainers and medical care and thousands of dollars worth of equipment, clothes, and shoes, he said. That, plus other financial aid going away, could up the cost of college by $10,000 or more each year for athletes like Miller. And you can't put a dollar amount on giving up a lifelong pursuit.
There's a part of me that's like, I know I have so much more to give in the sport. But the other part of me is like, you know, is this my sign to maybe try other things?
It's still unclear how all this will resolve. This week, lawyers negotiating the settlement are supposed to bring a new solution to Judge Wilkin, like a grandfather clause or some other way to ease in the roster limits. But it's no guarantee their solution will earn her approval. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For decades, producers for champagne in France have relied on U.S. buyers. But U.S. tariffs and tariff threats have some vintage producers saying that era is over. Many European winemakers no longer see the United States as a market they can count on, as NPR's Rebecca Rossman discovered in France's Champagne region.
So here you can see Chardonnay vines.
Fifth-generation champagne maker Charles Fournier is showing me his family tree in the form of a kind of family vine. These vines were planted by his grandfather over 70 years ago and still bear fruit today.
And we hope that our kids will go on pruning the same wine.
Same wine, same vines. but maybe not the same sales strategy. Forney has spent nearly 30 years cultivating ties with American distributors. But now he's facing a new reality, uncertainty about the future of his exports to the U.S.
We do not trust, because now we say we don't know what will happen. You have really the impression that you are enemies.
And President Trump's 90-day pause on reciprocal tariffs hasn't helped, he says. He finds Trump's decision-making too volatile and still doesn't know at what percent champagne will be taxed under the new tariffs.
We spoke about 200, now it's 20, and perhaps tomorrow it will be 6,000.
Which is why he's now looking to pivot. Forney leads me down into a chilly wine cellar where thousands of bottles are stacked and ready for export. Today, 18% of his sales go to the U.S., but he says he's shifting focus to more stable markets like Brazil. It's a tough new reality. For years, the U.S. was France's top champagne buyer, a driver of both growth and prestige. But this uncertainty goes both ways.
It's just a horrific kind of self-inflicted wound on American companies.
Harmon Skernick is a New York-based wine importer. In a worst-case scenario, he says, wines from abroad could disappear from American shelves entirely, and American wines can't simply fill in the gap.
We can't buy as much American wine. Not to mention the fact that these products are not fungible.
In other words, California bubbly isn't a perfect substitute, and the fallout could affect domestic sales too. Skernick says this will eventually trickle down to American consumers, who will likely have to pay a higher price on imported wines or change the way they drink. Back in the Champagne region, just steps off the famous Boulevard de Champagne, I stumble upon a group of American bubbly drinkers who tell me they actually support Trump's tariffs. One of them is 29-year-old Justin Fishman.
We're tariffing a luxury item, I would say. Like, champagne's not something that everybody needs on a daily basis.
Fishman's friend Joseph Sick from Kentucky agrees, though his drink of choice isn't exactly under threat.
I'm gonna drink what I want to drink at home, no matter what.
What do you want to drink at home?
Bourbon.
Back at Forney's estate, he offers a bittersweet toast.
Cheers, Sam.
Okay, cheers. Santé.
Forney says he wishes Trump realized that all this is more than just about champagne.
You know, when you do that with a country, it's not a business, it's a long-term relationship with the people.
And once that's uncorked, it may not be so easy to bottle it back up again. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, the Champagne Region, France.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ilse Chang. 2 months ago, the U.S. deported almost 300 people to Panama. These were asylum seekers. Many were fleeing civil wars or political or religious persecution in countries like Iran, China, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Cameroon. Some of these people are still stuck in Panama, not sure where they can go next. Reporter Manuel Rueda has been hearing their stories.
This old school in Panama City has been turned into a shelter for asylum seekers who were deported from the U.S. in February. There are 49 people staying here in the gym where they sleep on mattresses and take Spanish lessons in the afternoon.
Caballo.
Cabra.
Enda, a hairstylist from Cameroon, fled from her country last year after soldiers in her village accused her of supporting a separatist group. For security reasons, she asked us not to reveal her full name. She explained why she left her home country.
I've been held in prison for 2 weeks. The torture, the beatings. So when I was able to escape for my life, I was happy to do so. And the only place I could think of was the United States because of one, I knew I would be secure. Two, I have family there.
Endem crossed the U.S. border at the end of January and turned herself over to the Border Patrol to seek asylum. But she says she wasn't given a chance to file an asylum claim, which usually includes an interview with a caseworker.
That's what we were waiting for, but it never happened. It never happened.
Instead, Endem was held at a detention center in San Diego for 3 weeks. And in February, she was put on one of the deportation flights to Panama.
We had no idea we were coming here. Nobody said anything. When we got out of the plane, then we were like, oh, this is really strange. Then we see the flags. It's not, oh, this is not, I mean, this is Panama flag.
Endem and the other asylum seekers who ended up in Panama were removed from the U.S. under 212F, a section of the U.S. Immigration and Nationality Act that was written in 1952.
Which essentially allows the president to determine or to bar people from entering the country.
Rachel Schmidtke is a spokesperson for the human rights group Refugees International. She says that the migrants who were deported to Panama were denied due process. Instead of hearing these migrants out and deciding if they had legitimate claims, Schmidtke said the Trump administration saved itself some time by sending them to Panama.
The question of like the legality of what's happening is a little bit murky here. I think it's a way of scaring people into not wanting to even seek asylum at the U.S. border.
The U.S. government says it followed due process and was never told by these migrants that their lives were in danger. That's the claim the migrants deny. When they arrived in Panama, the migrants were locked up in a big hotel in between the city's skyscrapers. Artemis Azemzadeh, an asylum seeker from Iran, recorded a video from the hotel, alerting the media to the group's location. Azemzadeh says that officials in Panama tried to pressure her and others in the group to get on repatriation flights.
They say, I never come back to my country because I will die if I come back.
Those who refused to go back home were sent to an isolated camp on the edge of the remote Darien jungle, where they had to sleep in small buildings made from plastic sheets.
It was like a prison. No privacy, no good food, no good water. For going to the toilet or take a shower, they come to you nowhere alone.
But then, during the first week of March, Panama released them from the camp, following multiple complaints from human rights groups. The migrants were dropped off at a bus terminal in Panama City and told they could stay in the country for up to 90 days. Panama's government did not provide any support to the asylum seekers, however, garnering more criticism.
We have to understand that these people do not speak Spanish and they are in a country they don't know and they have no network here.
Father Marco Gomez is the Panama director for Fe y Alegría, a Catholic group that runs education programs. His group decided to host the asylum seekers at one of its schools in Panama City.
I would say we are doing the good Samaritan work. You know, it's good to receive the foreigner, to help them as much as we can, and also urge government to fix this.
Out of the original group of 300 asylum seekers, there are about 70 still here. Some are at the school, and some in apartments rented by UNICEF. Some of the migrants have said they might apply for asylum in Panama, but others are still hoping that the United Nations can refer them to wealthier countries like Canada or the United Kingdom that have better programs for asylum seekers.
You know, I'm in a foreign country. I never planned for here. It's another language. So I confused. What should I do?
Artemis Azemzadeh from Iran says it's a stressful situation because the threat of deportation is still looming.
Every night I cry because I'm really scared.
For NPR News, I'm Manuel Rueda in Panama City.
President Trump announced he wants to impose a 100% tariff on movies produced outside of the U.S. NPR's Mandalay Del Barco reports the film and TV industry has some questions about how that would work.
On his social media platform Truth Social Sunday night, President Trump declared that America's movie industry is, quote, dying a very fast death. He said Hollywood is being devastated by other nations that draw filmmakers and studios away from the U.S. with incentives. He called their efforts a national security threat. Here's what he shared with reporters outside of Air Force One in audio from the Associated Press.
If they're not willing to make a movie inside the United States, and we should have a tariff on movies that come in. And not only that, governments are actually giving big money. I mean, they're supporting them financially.
Many American films and TV shows are produced entirely or partially around the world. For example, the upcoming Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, was shot on a Norwegian archipelago and other locales.
Smart people on every side are close to panicking.
Countries like Canada, the UK, and Australia have long offered productions generous tax incentives, rebates, grants, and new sound stages to work in. Trump gave no details about how the movie tariffs would work and who would pay.
We have so many questions.
Stephen Jaworski is vice president of production with A&E Studios, headquartered in Los Angeles.
Production in the United States and specifically California is at a massive decline, but it's really hard to weigh in and understand exactly what a 100% tariff on foreign productions mean and how it would impact our industry.
Beyond Hollywood, other countries have also reacted with confusion to the headlines. The CEO of Screen Producers Australia wrote that the news will send shockwaves worldwide. And the head of the UK's Entertainment Industry Workers Union says the tariffs would deal a knockout blow to the country's film and TV production industry. President Trump told reporters that he also blames California's Governor Gavin Newsom for allowing productions to leave the state. But Newsom's office said in a statement that the governor has been working to more than double the amount of tax incentives his state offers productions to shoot and film in California. A spokesperson said the governor will review a more detailed proposal if the president has one. And today, Trump said he plans to meet with members of the film industry to make sure they're happy with his plan. Mandalay Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the John D. and Catherine.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.